Welcome to ST302, Survey of Bible Doctrine. This is an introductory class in theology or Bible doctrine. It covers all the major areas of systematic theology and it has an emphasis on salvation. The first lesson is Lesson 0 on theological subjects and study. Each lesson will have objectives, and again, it's the objectives that are also contained in the workbook that we will be evaluating you on. There are many things that I will say beyond the objectives in the lectures, but I won't test you on those things. Again, I will narrow in on the objectives themselves in terms of evaluating you with respect to what those say. So, the objectives: by the end of this unit, you should be able to define systematic theology. Number two, define the different disciplines related to systematic theology. And number three, to identify reasons why the study of theology is important. We begin with theology itself as a subject of study. The word theology comes from the Greek word theos, which means God, and combined with the word logos, which means word or discourse. So literally, it is a discourse about God or a study of God. In Thomas Aquinas's Summa Theologica, he begins with the issue of asking the question, is sacred doctrine, which is the more ancient term for systematic theology, is sacred doctrine a science? And by science, he means, does it give man true knowledge? And he answers that it does, that theology is a science. And it appears, he says, that everything we need for this life is found in the sciences. That is what man learns for himself using natural powers of reason or reasoning. But he makes a distinction between that way or that method at arriving at truth and what God has given us in the scriptures. He says that God has given us a goal that surpasses our human reasoning, and that is contained in scripture itself. What is contained in Scripture are certain things that we could not know on our own. We could not have arrived at through our own human reasoning. And hence, it is a gift from God, and it is a goal that He has that surpasses our own human reasoning. He also recognizes that there are certain truths that must be made known to man by divine revelation. There are some truths that he identifies that man can discover and know by human reason alone, or by the principles of human reason alone. Such things as the existence of God, a certain truth about his nature, that is God's nature, and certain things about the immortality of the soul, he recognizes could be known by human reason itself. These things are also, however, contained in Scripture. And hence they can be known by revelation as well as the philosophical sciences. And it's interesting that he makes an observation that they are revealed to us, and he gives reasons why they are revealed to us, such things as most people will not take the time to pursue the philosophical sciences to arrive at and understand an argument for the existence of God, let's say. People are occupied in life with other duties and other things and won't take the time to do that. Therefore, they're given to us by divine revelation. So there's a category in which some things can be known by the philosophical sciences and also divine revelation. There are also things contained in Scripture that go beyond the philosophical sciences or human reasoning and can only be known by divine revelation, such things as the Trinity. He also recognizes that there are different ways of knowing in the sciences. And that becomes important to make a distinction between the way the sciences or the disciplines arrive at certain truth. He also recognizes the fact that there are layers or levels to the sciences. There are lower sciences and higher sciences. And Aquinas says that theology is the highest of the sciences. The lower sciences would be things like the study of nature, or the philosophical sciences, or history, or things like that. All of those subjects of study are lower than the theological science, and they inform the theological science. They arrive, the lower sciences arrive, at knowing things differently than the higher science or the theological science. And it's the theological science alone that combines what is in the lower sciences along with revelation from God contained in Scripture in order to arrive at sacred doctrine and constituting it as a science that is knowledge that is there for man to know in order for him to live his life. He also points out, and it's worthy to note, that no sound philosophy will ever come in conflict with sacred doctrine. That is, since God is the author of nature and also the author of Scripture, the two cannot be in conflict. Now, certainly humans can misunderstand one or the other, but ultimately they have to be in agreement. They cannot conflict with one another because he is the author and the source of both of them. Today we call sacred doctrine systematic theology. But it's defined in modern systematic theologies pretty much the same. Dr. Geiser defines it as systematic theology is an attempt to construct a comprehensive and consistent whole out of all revelation from God, whether special, which is biblical, or general, which is in nature, revelation. So even here in a modern systematic theology, we recognize that it's an attempt of humans, so in that sense it's synthetic, to construct and to make a comprehensive construction that is consistent out of both realms of God's revelation, special revelation, which is the Bible, and general revelation, which is nature. Your textbook also follows suit by saying systematic theology correlates the data of biblical revelation as a whole in order to exhibit systematically the total picture of God's self-revelation. Systematic theology may include historical backgrounds, apologetics and defense, and exegetical work, but it focuses on the structure of biblical doctrine. So even here in Dr. Ryrie's text, we have systematic theology taking from other disciplines in order to construct its science or its body of knowledge. Any approach to systematic theology that does not take truth found outside of Scripture and general revelation is an incorrect approach to the science, and it's not really constituting the science itself. Again, systematic theology, as we'll see, is different than other approaches to theology in that it takes from both special and general revelation. There are various disciplines of systematic theology, and we'll look at the major ones and define them here. The first one is prolegomena. It's from a Greek word, pro, which means before, and lego means I say, so it's literally before I say. Prolegomena studies the philosophical preconditions to doing theology. It deals with issues such as the existence of God, what God is like in terms of his nature, also issues dealing with revelation, biblical revelation, miracles, and other types of things, and we'll spend more time on that in a subsequent lecture. Bibliology is the study of the Bible or an introduction to the Bible itself, particularly its inspiration, canonicity, issues dealing with inerrancy, and so forth. It comes from the Greek word biblios. Theology proper is the study of the existence and nature of God and also includes the Trinity. It comes from the Greek word for God, which is theos. Christology is the study of Christ, his deity, and so doctrines surrounding him. It comes from the Greek word Christos. Hamartiology comes from the Greek word for sin, harmartia, and it's the study of sin. Soteriology is the study of salvation, coming from the Greek word soterios. Ecclesiology is the study of the church, coming from the Greek word for church, which is ekklesia. And eschatology is the study of end things or the last things, and comes from the Greek word eschatos. There are several reasons to study theology, and I will give you a few of them here, but let me give you one overall reason that I think is the most important reason. Thomas Aquinas once said that the principal function of his life was to speak about God, and I think that that should be something that is incorporated into our life. It should be a principal function of our lives that we correctly think about God and we correctly speak about God. And one of the ways to make that happen at a higher level is to study the subject of theology. And that's what I think the overarching goal or reason for studying theology is. Here are some other reasons. First, it organizes all the doctrines necessary to Christianity. I grew up in the church and was exposed to a lot of Christian teaching and a lot of Christian doctrine. And I can remember thinking at one point, especially when I was in high school, how everything related to each other. I thought about angels, for example, how that related to other things in the Bible and what all the verses were on angels. And I had never been exposed in the church to anything close to a systematic theology. Finally, someone gave me a text. It was actually Dr. Ryrie's text on systematic theology. And here I saw, for the first time, the organization of all the doctrine. It's one thing to be taught here and there about different doctrines and teachings, which is certainly important. It's another thing to have it all put together for you and to be organized for you. And that's what systematic theology does. It organizes all the doctrines that are necessary to Christianity. Second, it enables a defense of Christian beliefs. Apologetics is all about defending the Christian faith, but systematic theology shows apologetics what is the Christian faith, what it is that should be defended. So apologists should study Christian doctrines so they know what the faith is that they're defending. So it's important to apologetics as well as other subjects in terms of providing a defense of the Christian faith, because it, after all, shows what that faith is. A third, it is essential for the maturity of believers. 2 Timothy 3:16 says, "All Scripture is inspired by God and profitable for teaching, for reproof, for correction, for training in righteousness, so that the man of God may be adequate, equipped for every good work." This verse tells us we should study the Scripture in order to obtain reproof, correction, and training in righteousness. That would enable us to go on to spiritual maturity. And doing it systematically in terms of a study of a science or a subject can help aid that growth and maturity. And fourth, it can protect believers from heresy. 1 John 4 says, "Beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits to see whether they are from God, because many false prophets have gone out into the world." And Jude 4 says, "For certain persons have crept in unnoticed." So systematic theology shows us what the Christian faith is to believe. That helps us with regards to apologetics, but it also helps us with what is known as heresy, or also referred to as polemics, that is, false beliefs that creep into the church, as Jude says. In studying what the Christian faith is, we also are studying what it is not. And this will help us to counteract heresies that can creep into the church. It also provides a comprehensive understanding of all reality. Doing systematic theology really serves as the foundation of the Christian worldview. In other words, as we develop a view of various things out there in our world, we need to have a foundation for doing that, and it's systematic theology that provides that foundation, so that a view that we develop can't go against our foundation, it can't go against our systematic theology, or it's a wrong or incorrect view. It has to be in accordance with that understanding. And it's important to point out that this is the only subject that does that. It's the only subject that takes in both general and special revelation, giving us a comprehensive understanding of reality in which can form the basis for us understanding and having views of other things. Now, there are other theologies and other approaches, and it's these theologies that are lower than systematic theology. It's these theologies, such as we'll look at here, two of them, biblical and historical theology, that actually inform systematic theology. But their approach and their method is very different than systematic theology. It's legitimate, but again, it's not the highest of the sciences, which is systematic theology. Dr. Ryrie says that biblical theology is that branch of theological science which deals systematically with the historically conditioned progress of the self-revelation of God as deposited in the Bible. Biblical theology limits itself to the study of Scripture itself and the exegesis of Scripture. It might delve into historical issues related to a particular book of the Bible, but it narrows itself to, let's say, the Old Testament theology or the New Testament theology. Or even more narrow, it can lead us to the theology in the Pentateuch, or the theology in the Minor Prophets, or it can lead us in the New Testament to Pauline theology or Johannine theology. It can be that narrow to a particular person or time period. Historical theology, Dr. Ryrie says, focuses on what those who studied the Bible thought about its teachings, either individually or collectively, as in the pronouncements of church councils. It shows how the church has formulated both truth and error. In historical theology, it's mostly a historical approach in which it looks at certain individuals and how they did theology. Those who did it correctly in terms of truth, Christian truth, and also in terms of heretics and views that opposed the truth. And it looks at least in two ways, it approaches it in at least two ways by looking at it in terms of historical era. We might speak of the early church's theology, or we might speak of Reformation theology. It can also study it in terms of the doctrines themselves. In other words, it can say, in terms of theology proper, what is the view of theology proper that has been held historically by people throughout time? This is a legitimate theology, it's in and of itself, but again, it is a lower science and it informs systematic theology, which is the higher science. Let's contrast them in a chart. Biblical theology studies the Bible itself, or what we might call special revelation, is its source, while historical theology studies historical sources related to theological understanding and writings related to that. Systematic theology alone would certainly use all that is contained in biblical historical theologies, but go even beyond that. It would study the Bible, those theologies, and even things outside the Bible. So it includes the broadest categories of general and special revelation. In biblical theology, it examines the individual parts of Scripture or the individual books of Scripture. In historical theology, it studies a historical period or doctrines. In systematic theology, it's interested in the collective whole. The results? For biblical theology, it is to arrive at a theology for a particular biblical writer or a certain period in time. For historical theology, it is the study of the writer or his period in writing. But in systematic theology, it is a comprehensive theology. It studies and the results correspond to all of Revelation, both the general and special revelation. And the methods are very different too. Biblical theology is primarily concerned with exegetical and historical studies. In historical theology, it's historical research that is the methodology. But in systematic theology, it's here that we want to be philosophical. We want to be looking at both general and special revelation and having a philosophical method that puts it all together for us and is inferential, looking at both things outside of Scripture as well as within Scripture. And this is the hallmark of systematic theology. In closing, I want to emphasize the importance of prolegomena and also distinguish it from Christian apologetics. Sometimes my students, when we do prolegomena, and we actually have a course that studies it on a more in-depth level in ST 301. We do about half the class in prolegomena and half the class in bibliology. So you get a much more in-depth exposure there, and I will have a brief exposure to you in a lecture on prolegomena and in bibliology to get you started. But prolegomena is not Christian apologetics. Now, it certainly will take from Christian apologetics various arguments and points, but its objective is very different than apologetics. Again, in apologetics, it's about defending the historic Christian faith. In prolegomena, the goal of prolegomena is to establish a correct approach to theology as opposed to other approaches to theology. And so it's going to take from whatever it needs to take from in terms of a science in order to establish that approach and establish it in such a way in which it is in agreement with the affirmations of Scripture itself. There are various subjects of prolegomena. Dr. Geiser lays these out. Metaphysics, which is the study of being or ultimate reality, God. It also includes the study of miracles or the supernatural, revelation, as well as epistemology, which is the study of truth and knowledge and how we know. It also includes logic, semantics, or the study of meaning. It includes issues related to language or linguistics. And finally, it concludes with a methodology in terms of doing a systematic theology. Again, I want to emphasize how important prolegomena is. It deals with the preconditions for doing theology, and it is often the case that a wrong prolegomena will lead to a wrong understanding of Scripture and a wrong understanding of theology itself. Many mistakes that we see people make with regards to the Scriptures or theology are usually traceable back to an error or a mistake or a lack thereof of their prolegomena. We could not interpret the Bible or understand our Bible correctly without a prolegomena. To show you how important it is, let me give you a brief example. How would you reconcile the following two verses? From Exodus 32:14, we read, "So the Lord changed his mind about the harm which he said he would do to his people." And in Numbers 23:19, we read, "God is not a man that he should lie, nor a son of man that he should change his mind." So in one verse, and need I remind you that both of these were written by Moses, in one of these verses, it says that the Lord changed his mind. And in the other verse, it says, God does not change his mind like a man. Now, there certainly could be things that we would find that would be helpful to us reconciling these verses if we did biblical theology or if we did historical theology. Certainly, that would be helpful or beneficial. But I would like to submit to you that ultimately the reconciliation or the basis for reconciling these verses is found in our prolegomena. Again, prolegomena provides the philosophical basis for understanding Scripture and God. And it is there that we would discover either that God does change or that he doesn't change. And as you will see in the lecture that I will give on prolegomena, we will see how absolutely ridiculous it is for someone to hold that God would change his mind. So therefore, it puts us in the position that if God does not change, that we must do something with the Scripture that speaks about God changing his mind. And that means that we have to have a reason that the biblical author would use the phrase that the Lord changed his mind. And that would put us into going into the issue of anthropomorphisms that are used throughout Scripture, which we will have more to say on later. Exodus 32:14, because our prolegomena tells us that God does not change, must be using an anthropomorphism. It must be into the category of narrative, in which it describes God in anthropomorphic terms or in metaphorical terms in order for us to understand him and what is going on in the story. It is not intended to tell us that God's nature changes. Numbers 23, for example, is in more of the area of didactic teaching, teaching directly about what God is like. In fact, the comparison is being made there between man and God, and that God is not a man, and therefore does not change his mind. The teaching is much more along the lines of didactic teaching concerning the very nature of God. It's the basis for making this distinction is not found in Scripture itself ultimately. Again, you might find hints and suggestions of it in other theologies, but the basis for this distinction, that I say God doesn't change versus changing, is found in a philosophical prolegomena. I could just as well have used other examples. Let me give you another one briefly. Miracles, for example. There are some theologians that approach the Scriptures who say miracles, as recorded in Scripture, did not actually happen in history. Now, I say that they did actually happen in history. Now, if I'm going to debate or argue with someone who holds that they didn't, I'm not going to be able to settle the issue by examining the text of Scripture itself with regards to that issue. Why? Because that's connected to a worldview issue. If I want to show that someone has a incorrect view with regards to miracles in Scripture, I'm ultimately going to settle that question not in the text of Scripture, but in prolegomena, or in dealing with the philosophical conditions related to the supernatural and miracles. That's where the debate is going to take place, and that's where it should take place. And then once I settle that miracles can happen, then I can approach the Scriptures with the belief in the supernatural and interpret them properly as having happened in history.